you think about this country, like, it's kind of run by the multinationals. It's kind of economy is provided.
Well, the
by
world,
the
like, I mean, the reality is that's the world. We live in a global economy.
No, that's the world we live in.
Look,
if you go to Spain, if you go to Andalusia, you see the size of mountains. Up three quarters of the way up the mountain is tilled. You know.
Yeah, and they have youth unemployment of 40%.
Nevertheless, they try to work. You know? We have nobody offering us a vision of an indigenous, self-motivating economy or society.
But that's, John, I have to, and I don't mean to sound disrespectful or smart in any way, you sound almost like, you know, sort of De Valera's.
That's bullshit. You see, that's what people always say. We have to start.
By the way, I don't think there was anything particularly wrong with that speech. I think it was a noble speech.
Yeah,
in
so
any
do
way,
I. But I'm not arguing for it. I mean, you're dead right, and we could have another big discussion about that because, you know, if we had actually applied some of the values of Dev's speech back into
I agree, in the Celtic Tire, we wouldn't
have got into the hole we got into in 2008.
Yeah.
But my point is, like, that we need to actually have a vision that is not kind of prostitution.
Okay,
our 12.5% tax rate is basically our red light to the world.
Okay,
that's what it is.
Are you, I suppose my question is, are you yearning for a world and an Ireland that's gone and passed and can't be
I'm yearning for an Ireland that would be itself, that would come back to creating its own means and its own way of being.
But didn't we try that in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and it didn't work?
We had a totally inadequate leadership. You know, for all, you know, I'm not praising De Valera. I think that there was a lot of inadequacies in that period and thereafter. We never really got it right. But we do have, like a lot of European countries, you know, there's a kind of a contract being played in a lot of European countries. Leave Ireland for the moment. Go to Italy. In all the things that matter, Italy is one of the most richest, the richest countries in the world. And yet it is poverty stricken at the moment. It has culture, it has history, it has art, it has music, it has everything you could possibly...
Food. Yeah.
Yeah, it can be the most beautiful food. It's the most beautiful country. And yet they're scraping, like, it's just... There's something happened in Europe and we need leaders who will actually speak about it and speak up against it. Now, so I say to people... There are two kinds of unrepresentability. There's the old who no longer want to be represented because these people are not representing them anyway. And there's the young who don't want to be represented because they think they're too smart for the kind of gobdaws who are now running.
So who's your message to? Is it to young people? Is it to politicians? And how concerned are you about
the
future?
Concerned, but I actually think, like a lot of things, it all comes down fundamentally to the conversation we're having. And unfortunately, the level of our conversation is banal in the extreme and we don't have the capacity anymore to have these conversations. I mean,
are we not two middle-aged guys here just doing what middle-aged guys have done for decades?
I wouldn't regard myself as middle-aged. I mean, I don't know how many 122-year-old guys do you know?
Okay, I was being polite. But you know what I mean? Are we not two older guys who do what older guys have done for generations?
Shane,
the young people don't get it.
People always go on about as if, you know, that a nation could regenerate itself. There are real questions here about what's happened to our culture as a result of the technology that has been used, the way people are being detached from reality. Again, Baudelaire talks about an idea of us, we live in a simulacrum of reality. And this is very visible in this syndrome here, whereby we have a lot of our up-and-coming electorate who seem to think that somehow the nation, the country, you know, is just, it's all there and can be just improved. It can fall apart overnight. That's the point. And we don't actually have anybody now. There's no channel in this society anymore for big ideas about who we are and where we're going. You know, I've given up on it. I'm no longer
a journalist. You say you've given up on it. And look, that's obviously your choice. But by abstaining in the election, is that not a cop-out?
Well, no, you see, I think in all kinds of votes, abstaining is a respectable and legitimate option. If you look at the runners and you say, no, none of them really reflect my desire for this society or for me in my life or my children and me in our lives. No. You know, that's a kind of a cheap political gimmick that is always used. Oh, you have no right to speak because you didn't vote. You know, nonsense. You can not vote and speak even louder because the reason you didn't vote has a resonance as well. And that's something that we need to start waking up to. A lot of people don't vote. Why? Not because they're lazy, not because they're apathetic in that kind of cliched sense, but because they're not represented by politics, because they don't feel that politicians any longer speak to them. And the last 5 years have really, this syndrome has
been... Elect people who will represent you then.
Yeah, but where are they?
Vote for people.
You see, this is the struggle that people are now engaged in. That's another... They're struggling to find the combination, as it were, that will actually get them out of this hole. The independents are a sign of this. I've talked before with Ming Flanagan down where I come from, when he was elected. You know, people's almost like they say... Like, he's the least likely guy you'd think at that time that would ever be elected. Mm. People said, to hell with it. This is, you know, mainly a rural constituency. He's a young guy, you know, looks funny, you know, wears funny clothes, all the rest of it. But they say, look it, he's not going to be any worse than some of the gobdaws around here, and he might actually be better. But it doesn't really get anywhere because it can't, the system doesn't allow for anything other than those guys standing in the back row shouting as if they're at the back of the class, you know, with a fairly lax teacher. And that's not going to get us anywhere. That kind of token oppositionism. We need a system that will allow us to create, put ideas into the mix, ask people what they want, talk to people. I mean, you know, I think there are other aspects of this, like going back to last year and all that, what I don't want to get into. But really, we actually have, I think at the moment, a huge problem with the absence of conversation. That's our fundamental problem, because it's not possible for me or anybody who wants to say something with any depth. I'm not praising myself, I'm just saying that if you try to say a complicated thing, it's not possible in the culture we have by and large. And the result is that with the Twitter and all this stuff, you get caricatured as whatever and you get buried. Okay. So this has to stop. Unless we want to head over the cliff, this has to stop, because we cannot go on. We are like, you know, Donald Trump could pull the plug on our 12.5% if he was elected. Any president could. Saunders could do it. We need to wake up to the fact that we are naked from the waist down economically.
Okay. Well, look, I hope we had some of that conversation here today. You can read John's piece in the current issue of Village Magazine. Fascinating read indeed. John Waters, good to have you in and good to have you back with us.
Thanks
a lot. Back in a moment on The Sunday Show.
I read it at a time in my life, I suppose, you know, that I was looking back and remembering my own childhood and remembering being at school and perhaps feeling some regret that there were people I had lost contact with or I had fallen out with, and feeling sadness that I'd lost opportunities. And it touches all of that, I think, sense that we have as human beings. So fundamentally, the early part is a bit about that transition from childhood, adolescence into adulthood, when if you've been fortunate enough to have had a happy childhood and to have been sheltered from some of the harsh realities of life, you begin to realise as you mature actually what life really is like. Mm. And there's that sort of metaphor, if you like, at the heart of it as well.
Okay. I'm just looking, and I'm probably overanalyzing this, but I'm looking at your choices. You know, Richard Murphy, born, I suppose, Anglo-Irish, I suppose, if you want to describe it as that. James Joyce, who was kind of a, you know, the old saying about never a prophet in your own land, ended up living abroad. Jonathan Raven, who was English, writing about travelling in America. And now you have Kazuo Ishiguro, Japanese-born British author. Something of the outsider about all your choices.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but maybe that sort of appeals to me.
Okay.
And I think, and often the outsiders see things more clearly.
Oh, yeah. I suppose they see things a lot more clearly. Mm-hmm. They can stand almost removed from it. Now, your final choice is a book that, I mean, it's a brilliant book, but a book not without controversy, I think it's fair to say. Yeah. And you talked about your love of history and your passion for history, and this obviously fits in with that.
Well, it's Modern Ireland, 1600 to 1972, by historian Roy Forster. And I first read this when it was published, I think, back in the late 1980s. Now, it's a big doorstopper of a book, as you can imagine. If it covers this period, then it encompasses
a fair bit of
Irish history. And at the time, it just blew me away, because it was really it's narrative history, but it's also full of analysis. He's never afraid to come to conclusions about events, whether you agree with them or not. At the time, he was, I suppose, one of those historians who were, and it was used as a term of abuse, revisionists.
Yeah.
Now, I think any historian who wants to be called a historian really should be a revisionist, because it's always a process of revising the judgments that have been made by previous generations. So I suppose I was intrigued by that. What are these revisionists actually at? I'd read Ruth Dudley Edwards some years earlier, a biography she wrote about Padraig Pearse. So that drew me to his piece. But it's the breadth of his scholarship. It's the range of the period that he's willing to tackle, which you need a lot of, I think you need a lot of balls really to kind of get stuck into something like that. And I think he's probably the best historical writer, as in his use of the language. He's a great respect for language and for the right word and the right phrase and the right sentence. And all of that, I think, weaves together to create something really that's a quite exceptional piece of historical writing.
I mean, the term revisionism, I mean, do you think it's an overly simplistic term?
I think it's meaningless.
Yeah.
I mean, as I say, I think all history writing should revise. And I think if you went back and read, for example, Foster's account in this of the 1916-22 period, it's been overtaken by new material that's yeah. come online. And he himself has revised, I guess, his own assessment of that period. I think his latest book is called Vivid Faces, which focuses on that revolutionary generation. And I can see lots of evidence of him revising assessments that he made because a lot of new material is available through the pension records and through the military history, Bureau of Military History accounts and various other documents that have come to light. So that's actually what makes history reading so fascinating, I think, because it always changes. And our where we are today changes our perspective as well on events of the past.
I suppose when the book came out, it was at the height, probably you could say, of the troubles in Northern Ireland. And maybe a lot of people in Ireland were re-evaluating the traditional view we had of the 1916 Rising, the War of Independence. That obviously, I think the timing of the book definitely informs.
And he absolutely fed into that. Of course he did. And the evidence of that, or if you like, because how we commemorate 1916 in 2016 will be very different, I think we can safely say, from how it was commemorated in 1966.
Yeah.
Because our view has changed. It's probably a much more complex, much more nuanced interpretation of those events. He says at the outset, in the very first few pages, he talks about this, and I think it's almost, when I reread it again the last few days, it's almost like a manifesto, if you like. He says, and he's talking about this period, 1600, why he chose to start there. It was, of course, the point at which the Gaelic Order ended, the flight of the Earl, 1601, the Battle of Kinsale. And he says, as English authority established itself throughout the island, the incompleteness of conquest remained a salient truth. In 1600, as later, Ireland was characterised by a fragmented polity, varieties of peoples defining their Irishness differently, many of whom denied the legitimacy of the official state apparatus and lived indifferently outside its writ. So he's saying there, in 1600... and we can say today, Irishness is a very complex and very varied thing.
It is, and probably never more varied than it is today. I mean, it's interesting, that whole revisionism row that did take place back then, I imagine to people a lot, you know, younger than you and I imagine that debate is completely irrelevant.
I think
it
is probably largely put to bed now, isn't it?
Yeah. And
no bad thing, really, because I think it probably was a distraction from really what should have been our focus, which is how we, as far as possible, tried to be ruthlessly honest in our confrontation of our own history. And I think the Good Friday Agreement and the dispensation in Northern Ireland, all of that has fed into a different way of confronting and encountering our past, and a much more healthier way, I think.
I suppose, you mentioned 1916. We are coming up to the centenary. I know you'll probably be covering it as a broadcaster. I suppose a lot of us would have conflicted views about 1916. And for what it's worth, my own view would be I'm glad it happened. Yeah. I'm glad we are independent. But, you know, I am uncomfortable about some of the things that did happen, and obviously the legacy of that in the shape of the Troubles. Is it something you give much thought to?
Well, I think it's something as a nation we are going to struggle with, and we are going to try to come to terms with, if you like, in the next year or so, because it was an act of violence, quite clearly.
Albeit in the context of a different time, I suppose,
yes,
and different values and so on.
And, you know, there's lots of arguments around the legitimacy or not of the period. Actually, I don't think there are right or wrong answers to a lot of this. It happened. And the first thing is that it's important that we acknowledge it happened, understand the motivation of those who planned and took part in the Rising and in the subsequent War of Independence, recognise their motives for what they were, and try to be honest in the way we talk about the period. I mentioned Foster's latest book, this one about Vivid Faces. It's actually, for anybody, I think, probably trying to understand what was going on, it is really essential reading, because it presents the stories of a lot of the lesser-known individuals who were active in the national movement up to 1916 and afterwards. And it looks at this is really one of the things, I suppose, that attracts me to Foster as a historian. You know, he talks about theatre and he talks about newspapers, and he talks about their sex lives. And so he draws on so many different aspects of the human experience to build up this picture. And it really explained to me, I think for the first time, what was going on in that really kind of fevered atmosphere in the years leading up.
Extraordinary. I accept the point that you campaigned to get Enda Kenny out and that you're going to stick by that and not go into coalition with Fine Gael. But in all likelihood, there has to be one or other of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil has got to support the other for nomination for Taoiseach. That is the reality, isn't it?
Well, I certainly won't be supporting Enda Kenny for Taoiseach, and I say that here and now, and we've given that commitment as a party.
How can you say that?
Because the people rejected him and his policies.
Does that include abstaining in a vote for Taoiseach?
Well, I certainly won't be voting for Enda Kenny. What I will hope would happen, I think, is realistic, and it's what Fianna Fáil is now focused on, is trying us to win many of the independents, and I believe that many of them would be much more inclined to us for exactly the same reasons that I've outlined there, that they feel that Enda Kenny was rejected, that his policies were completely wrong, that they still don't seem to get the message, and that's very clear from listening to Pascal Donoghue this morning. I believe they've been inclined to come with us. Labour have said that they won't be supporting Enda Kenny in the next vote. Now, their position is going to be absolutely crucial because they have 7 votes there.
And they're hardly going to vote for Micheál, though, are they?
Well, they're going to have to go with somebody.
They were
last week in the Dáil, we had to listen to lecture after lecture from Labour about the necessity of Fianna Fáil going into government. Well, I think that the only way that we can go into government is with Micheál Martin as Taoiseach, and that's certainly something that I want, and it's something that the party wants.
Let's follow, because there's no doubt Fianna Fáil had a good election. Micheál Martin had a very good election. You've got 43 votes now because you've lost to Cairn Corda. Let's say, for example, you get 10 to 12 independents. That brings you up to 55.
Sure.
You're still more than 20 seats short, or 20 votes short of what it would take. You can't get to that without support from Fine Gael. And Fine Gael can't get to it without support from you.
Well,
at the very least, an abstention.
It's not a question of support, but it may well be that somebody would have to, and as you mentioned already, somebody would have to abstain. I mean, I think whoever emerges as the biggest group with independents, with smaller parties, is going to be in the driving seat. But that biggest group is not about the numbers. It's not about positions. It's about actually trying to get change to this country, actually trying to get policies that deal with the mortgage crisis. We've dozens of repossession cases in County Meath tomorrow morning in the Trim Court. The homeless crisis, we've in our county alone, we've 30 people, 30 households in temporary accommodation. There's way more in Dublin, as we know. So it's about actually trying to resolve those issues, and honestly trying to resolve them as soon as possible. And I hope that that can happen very, very quickly. But it's about a change of direction that the country demanded at the general election.
Okay.
That has to be implemented.
Pascal Donoghue, to be fair, gave a straight answer to the question when I said it is, we're talking effectively about a minority government being, and that means being led by either Enda Kenny or Micheál Martin. Would you go along with that? Is that the scenario we're in?
Look, I think it is, because we're not going into Grand Coalition. And in fairness, I think you've accepted this, and there, some elements of the media are starting to accept this. They've been putting us under tremendous pressure over the last 10 days to go back on what we said before the election, to go back on the mandate that we're given. I think people are beginning to accept that we're actually quite serious about this, that we don't want to go into Grand Coalition for a wide variety of reasons. And I have to say, I do agree with Pascal that I don't like this sectionalism of Irish politics, and that there's a party for this particular crowd here, there's a party for that, and everybody's against everybody.
Okay.
That's not positive, that's not good.
But the logical progression of what you're saying is that one or other of Fine Gael are going to have to support a Fianna Fáil nomination for Taoiseach, or at the very least abstain from it, or Fianna Fáil are going to have to, at the very least, abstain if Enda Kenny is nominated,
whoever emerges as the biggest group, obviously with the best set of policies, but whoever emerges as the biggest group is going to be in the driving seat. And I think it would be incumbent on maybe the other side to facilitate that. That doesn't mean voting for them. I think you would have to subtract the second group, if you like, from the overall numbers, and the minority government would have to have a majority of that number.
Okay.
So again,
the logical progression of what you're saying is, and I accept you're, as of now, you're saying we want Micheál Martin to be Taoiseach.
Yeah,
we're going to get the vote.
If though,
come the next vote on Taoiseach, if Enda Kenny is comfortably ahead, and I know you accept that, that may not happen.
He has Fine Gael, plus he has Michael Lowry at the moment. I think that's the commitments that he has at the moment.
If he is ahead, you can envisage the logical progression of what you're saying is you can envisage a scenario where Fianna Fáil would abstain from a vote for Taoiseach for Enda Kenny in the future and support him from the outside.
I can't say that. I'm certainly not supporting from the outside. That's not what's envisaged at all. It would be allowing a government which would have the, I suppose, not a majority, but the biggest number of seats in the Dáil, allowing them to be in office. But certainly in terms of supporting them, that's not the case at all.
There'd have to be some kind of deal. Otherwise, the government could follow the next budget then in that scenario.
Well, what I would envisage actually is a whole new way of doing politics, that nobody would be able to dictate the Dáil agenda.
Yeah, no, we get that. And that is important, and I'm not understating that. But they have to win a vote at budget.
Yes, and the only way they could do that is by a consensus among all of the parties trying to...
But you saw what happened on Thursday, Thomas. You're not going to get a consensus. At a certain point, you actually... I accept the point about a stronger Dáil, but you have to govern as well. You have to have the votes.
But there was no governing on Thursday. I mean, what was happening on Thursday...
Exactly.
I didn't...